You are tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz at 103.1 FM on the dial. I would like to welcome you to another episode of Dr. Mike's Health and Wellness Program. This will be episode 51. My name is Dr. Michael Joseph. I'm an MD and a naturopath and a teacher of meditation. And I have a program tomorrow night it's every Monday from 6 to 8. And the name of that other show is called The Awakening of the Self. It's about spiritual awakening, the awakening of your true consciousness. Anyway, the purpose of this health show is to educate you to preserve and restore your health if you've lost some of your health. The other purpose is to educate you enough so that you can make better decisions when you do fall sick, as we all will at some point in our life, and so you can understand and make better decisions and not be totally reliant on the drug companies and the pushers of drugs, which are the medical doctors of today. They know no other way of healing your body except what the drug companies tell them. And a lot of these drugs have serious side effects and intoxicate your body. There's a better way, and the better way is through the natural way, but you have to learn, you have to know, you have to understand. It's based on science, of course. We're not talking anything outside science. I'm a scientist myself. I have several degrees in science. But the way of trying to restore the body through drugs is not the optimal way to do that. We have a number on this program. It's 831-427-3772. So you can call in at any time during the show if you have any kind of medical question or you want to discuss anything. We also have an email here that I haven't started using yet, but I will sometime in the near future. And our slogan, I suppose, is for this program, I always have a slogan for my programs. And this slogan here is to eat more plant-based food and less animal-based food. And all the studies, scientific studies, show that all the inflammation, most of the inflammation that your body suffers from, and that's the basis of all the chronic diseases in the Western world, the basis of it is inflammation. So you got to move your diet away so it's not causing inflammation. Arachidonic acid that comes from animal meat and dairy, etc. Okay, that's good. Now we're about to get into the show now proper. But first we'll have a little music. And here we have Vivo Perle, Andrew Bocelli and Laura Pausini, Italian name. Ah, strange, no? Okay, we have something. My computer is not actually working correctly, so while I mess around with it, we'll start the program with a talk from. This is Dr. Michael Gregor, and he's a he's an MD, but he's also a nutritional expert. So his name of his talk is, Do Vegetarians Get Enough Protein? I'm not really asking people to become vegetarians, but I'd like to move you in that direction, you know, by eating more of a plant-based diet, fruits, vegetables, etc., that we'll go into later in the program, and less and less meat. Okay, here we go.
The largest study in history of those eating plant-based diets recently compared the nutrient profiles of about 30,000 non-vegetarians to 20,000 vegetarians, and about 5,000 vegans, flexitarians, and no meat except fish eaters, allowing us to finally put to rest the perennial question, do vegetarians get enough protein? The average requirement is 42 grams of protein a day. Non-vegetarians get way more than they need, and so does everyone else. On average, vegetarians and vegans get 70% more protein than they need every day. Surprising that there's so much fuss about protein in this country when less than 3% of adults don't make the cut, presumably folks on extreme calorie-restricted diets who just aren't eating enough food, period. But 97% of Americans get enough protein. There is a nutrient, though, for which 97% of Americans are deficient. Now that's a problem nutrient. That's something we really have to work on. Less than 3% of Americans get even the recommended minimum adequate intake of fiber. So the question isn't where do you get your protein, but where do you get your fiber? We only get about 15 grams a day. The minimum daily requirement is 31.5, so we get less than half the minimum. If you break it down by age and gender, after studying the diets of 12,761 Americans, the percentage of men between ages 14 and 50 getting the minimum adequate intake, zero. This deficit is stunning, in that dietary fiber has been protectively associated with the risk of diabetes, metabolic syndrome, cardiovascular disease, obesity, and various cancers, as well as high cholesterol, blood pressure, and blood sugars. Therefore, it is not surprising that fiber is now listed as a nutrient of concern in the dietary guidelines. Protein is not. One problem is that most people have no idea what's in their food. More than half of Americans think steak is a significant fiber source. By definition, fiber is only found in plants. There's no fiber in meat, dairy, or eggs, and little or no fiber in junk food. Therein lies the problem. Americans should be eating more beans, vegetables, fruits, whole grains. How are we doing on that? Well, 96% of Americans don't eat the recommended minimum daily intake of beans. 96% don't eat the measly minimum for greens. 99% don't get enough whole grains. Look at these numbers. Nearly the entire U.S. population fails to eat enough whole plant foods, and it's not getting any better. A lack of progress that's disappointing. Even semi-vegetarians, though, make the minimum for fiber, and those eating completely plant-based diets triple the average American intake. Now, when closing the fiber gap, you want to do it gradually, no more than about 5 extra grams of fiber a day each week until you can kind of work your way up, but it's worth it. Plant-derived diets tend to contribute significantly less fat, saturated fat, cholesterol, foodborne pathogens, while at the same time offering more fiber, folate, vitamin C, phytochemicals, all essential factors for disease prevention and optimal health and well-being. And the more plant foods, the better. Whole plant foods, the better. If you compare the nutritional quality of vegan versus vegetarian, semi-vegetarian, pesco-vegetarian, and omnivorous diets, traditional healthy diet indexing systems, like compliance with the dietary guidelines, consistently indicate the most plant-based diet as the most healthy one.
Okay, that hopefully will put your mind to rest. That's a kind of a rumor that was propagated by probably the meat industry that you're not getting enough protein if you eat if you're vegetarian. So that was a huge study. There was 20,000 people in boat camps, so maybe 40,000 or more people altogether, and they found that everyone got enough protein, 42 grams a day. except some extreme people, who low-carb people maybe, who didn't make that great. That was just 3% of the 100%. So it's very safe to be on a plant-based diet these days, and it's actually, all the studies show a better health if you're on a whole food plant-based diet. All the experts agree on that. So it's nothing contentious now. We just know that is the way to go. If that's, you don't have to do that overnight unless you want to. You can do that on a gradual basis by just start decreasing your meat and dairy intake, and even not too much eggs. It's all to do with inflammation and arachidonic acid. Okay, great. I think I've got my music back up, so we'll go ahead with some music now. And this is Angels We Have Heard on High.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome one of the world's greatest musical treasures, Andrea Bocelli.
Okay, that was Andrea Bocelli singing Angels We Have Heard on High. Haven't heard that song for a long time. It's not too bad of a song. I kind of like it. We're now ready for our next health piece, which will also be fairly short, like the last one. I just have to find it here on my agenda. I introduced curcumin or turmeric to you some time ago as being a very vital health to help to keep your health and restore it. And now I'm going to introduce something else. It's called, that's very vital. It has a huge reputation in the Arab world. It's called black seed. And it's called the remedy for everything but debt. So we'll hear a presentation on that right now. And it's something I'm looking for right now. I haven't found it in the health food store, but it's I might have to order it.
GreenMedInfo.com, bringing you another audio article. Black seed, the remedy for everything but death. This humble but immensely powerful seed kills MRSA, heals the chemical weapon poisoned body, stimulates regeneration of the dying beta cells within the diabetic's pancreas, and yet too few even know it exists. The seeds of the annual flowering plant Nigella sativa have been prized for their healing properties since time immemorial, while frequently referred to among English-speaking cultures as Roman coriander, black seed, black cumin, black caraway, and onion seed, it is known today primarily as black seed, which is, at the very least, a very accurate description of its physical appearance. The earliest record of its cultivation and use come from ancient Egypt. Black seed oil, in fact, was found in Egyptian pharaoh Tutankhamun's tomb, dating back to approximately 3,300 years ago. In Arabic cultures, black cumin is known as Habatul Barakah, meaning the seed of blessing. It is also believed that the Islamic prophet Muhammad said of it that it is a remedy for all diseases except death. Many of black cumin's traditionally ascribed health benefits have been thoroughly confirmed in biomedical literature. In fact, since 1964, there have been 458 published peer-reviewed studies referencing it. We have indexed salient research, available to view on greenmedinfo.com on our black seed page, on well over 40 health conditions that may be benefited from the use of the herb, including 20 distinct pharmacological actions it expresses, such as analgesic, antibacterial, anti-inflammatory, anti-ulcer, anticholinergic, antifungal, antihypertensive, antioxidant, antispasmodic, antiviral, bronchodilator, glucogenesis inhibitor, hepatoprotective, hypotensive, insulin sensitizing, interferon inducer, leukotriene antagonist, renoprotective, and tumor necrosis factor alpha inhibitor. These 22 pharmacological actions are only a subset of a far wider number of beneficial properties intrinsic to the black seed. While it is remarkable that this seed has the ability to positively modulate so many different biological pathways, this is actually a rather common occurrence among traditional plant medicines. Our project has identified over 1,600 natural compounds with a wide range of health benefits, and we are only in our first 5 years of casual indexing. There are tens of thousands of other substances that have already been researched, with hundreds of thousands of studies supporting their medicinal value. Take turmeric, for example. We have identified research indicating its value in over 600 health conditions, while also expressing over 160 different potentially beneficial pharmacological actions. You can view the quick summary of over 1,500 studies we have summarized on our turmeric research page, which includes an explorative video on turmeric. Professional database members are further empowered to manipulate the results according to their research criteria. This should help people realize how voluminous and supportive literature indicating the medicinal value of natural substances such as turmeric and black seed really is. Black seed has been researched for very specific health conditions. Let's take a look at some of the most compelling applications. Type 2 diabetes. 2 grams of black seed a day resulted in reduced fasting glucose, decreased insulin resistance, increased beta cell function, and reduced glycosylated hemoglobin in human subjects. Helicobacter pylori infection. Black seeds possess clinically useful anti-H. pylori activity, comparable to triple eradication therapy. Epilepsy. Black seeds were traditionally known to have anticonvulsive properties. A 2007 study with epileptic children, whose condition was refractory to conventional drug treatment, found that a water extract significantly reduced seizure activity. High blood pressure. The daily use of 100 to 200 milligrams of black seed extract twice daily for 2 months was found to have blood pressure lowering effects on patients with mild hypertension. Asthma. Thymoquinone is superior to the drug fluticasone in an animal model of asthma. Another study, this time in human subjects, found that boiled water extracts of black seed have relatively potent anti-asthmatic effects on asthmatic airways. Acute tonsillopharyngitis. Characterized by tonsil or pharyngeal inflammation, mostly viral in origin, black seed capsules have been found to significantly alleviate throat pain and reduce the need for painkillers in human subjects. Chemical weapons injury. A randomized, placebo-controlled human study of chemical weapons-injured patients found that boiled water extracts of black seed reduced respiratory symptoms, chest wheezing, and pulmonary function test values, as well as reduced the need for drug treatment. Colon cancer. Cell studies have found that black seed extract compares favorably to the chemo agent 5-fluorouracil in the suppression of colon cancer growth, but with a far higher safety profile. Animal research has found that black seed oil has significant inhibitor effects against colon cancer in rats without observable side effects. MRSA. Black seed has antibacterial activity against clinical isolates of methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus. Opiate addiction or withdrawal. A study on 35 opiate addicts found black seed as an effective therapy in long-term treatment of opiate dependence. Sometimes the biblical reference of faith the size of a mustard seed moving mountains comes to mind in connection with natural substances like black seed. After all, do seeds not contain within them the very hope for continuance of the entire species that bore it? This supersaturated state of the seed, where life condenses itself down into an intensely miniaturized, holographic fragment of itself, promising the formation of future worlds within itself, is the very emblem of life's immense and immortal power. If we understand the true nature of the seed, how much life, past, present, and future, is contained within it, it will not seem so far-fetched that it is capable of conquering antibiotic-resistant bacteria, healing the body from chemical weapons poisoning, or stimulate the regeneration of dying insulin-producing beta cells in the diabetic. And that's just to name a fraction of black seed's experimentally confirmed powers. Moving the mountain of inertia and falsity associated with the conventional concept of disease is a task well suited for seeds and not chemicals. The greatest difference, of course, between a seed and a patented synthetic chemical is that nature made the seed, and men with profit motives and a deranged understanding of the nature of the body made the medicine. The time, no doubt, has come for food, seeds, herbs, plants, sunlight, air, clean water, and yes, even love, to assume once again their central place in medicine, which is to say, the art and science of facilitating self-healing within the human body. Failing this, the conventional medical system will crumble under its own growing weight of corruption, ineptitude, and iatrogenic suffering. To the degree that it reforms itself, utilizing non-patented and non-patentable natural compounds with actual healing properties, a brighter future awaits on the horizon. People will learn to take back control of their health themselves. Black seed and other food medicines hold the key to this self-empowerment. Thanks for listening. This is Lance Farsight for GreenMedInfo.com bringing you another informative article. Make sure to visit our website and subscribe to this channel to hear more and stay updated on your healthy lifestyle.
Okay, I think that was a nice little talk, an introduction to black seed. You've heard from his talk there's many hundred studies done on both turmeric and this black seed, and it has a strong reputation in the East for a long time. But we never hear of these scientific studies indicating its value in restoring health and maintaining health. And why is that? We don't see any ads in the paper with these kind of beneficial scientific studies. Maybe somebody out there has some idea about why that is. Maybe it's due to the fact that these are natural healing properties, remedies, and the drug companies, nobody can make money from natural things, basically. Not like the way they make the billions of dollars on synthetic drugs that they formulate in laboratories. Okay, if you have some thoughts on that, let's hear from you. The number is 831-425-3772. Yeah. Okay. From here, we're going to go to... I'm just setting up the next one here for you. Yeah, the next little clip, before we go into Dr. Michael Murray, who's written many books on... And is an expert on natural health and restoration and treating different diseases. We're going to go into a little clip here. It's only 2 or 3 minutes, and it's to do with milk. We've been totally indoctrinated by the milk industry that spends so many millions of dollars every year advertising.
Milk is touted to build strong bones. But a compilation of all the best studies found no association between milk consumption and hip fracture risk, so drinking milk as an adult may not help bones. But what about in adolescents? Harvard researchers decided to put it to the test. Studies have shown that greater milk consumption during childhood and adolescence contributes to peak bone mass and is therefore expected to help avoid osteoporosis and bone fractures in later life. But that's not what they found. Milk consumption during teenage years was not associated with a lower risk of hip fracture, and if anything, milk consumption was associated with a borderline increase in fracture risk in men. It appears that the extra boost in total body bone mineral density you get from getting extra calcium is lost within a few years, even if you keep the calcium supplementation up. This suggests a partial explanation for the long-standing enigma that hip fracture rates are highest in populations with the greatest milk consumption. Maybe an explanation why they're not lower, but why would they be higher? This enigma irked a Swedish research team, puzzled because studies, again and again, had shown a tendency of higher risk of fracture with a higher intake of milk. Well, there is a rare birth defect called galactosemia, where babies are born without the enzymes needed to detoxify the galactose found in milk, so they end up with elevated levels of galactose in their blood, which can cause bone loss, even as kids. So maybe, the Swedish researchers figured, even in normal people that can detoxify the stuff, it might not be good for the bones to be drinking it every day. And galactose doesn't just hurt the bones. That's what scientists use to cause premature aging in lab animals. They slip them a little galactose, and you can shorten their lifespan, cause oxidative stress, inflammation, brain degeneration, just with like the equivalent of 1 to 2 glasses of milk's worth of galactose a day. We're not rats, though, but given the high amount of galactose in milk, recommendations to increase milk intake for prevention of fractures could be a conceivable contradiction. So they decided to put it to the test, looking at milk intake and mortality, as well as fracture risk, to test their theory. 100,000 men and women followed for up to 20 years. What did they find? Milk-drinking women had higher rates of death, more heart disease, significantly more cancer for each glass of milk. 3 glasses a day was associated with nearly twice the risk of death, and they had significantly more bone and hip fractures, too. Men in a separate study also had a higher rate of death with higher milk consumption, but at least they didn't have higher fracture rates. So a dose-dependent higher rate of both mortality and fracture in women, and a higher rate of mortality in men with milk intake. But the opposite for other dairy products like soured milk and yogurt, which would go along with the galactose theory, since bacteria can ferment away some of the lactose. To prove it, though, we need a randomized controlled trial to examine the effect of milk intake on mortality and fractures. As the accompanying editorial pointed out, we better figure this out soon, as milk consumption is on the rise around the world.
Okay. Okay, that's about milk. It seems milk is not the best thing for you. I myself have stopped taking milk. There's a lot, besides the fact there's a lot of antibiotics and steroids and hormones in it. We've heard there's galactose in it. It's a type of protein that affects the bones negatively. And they found that incrementally, with every glass of milk that a person drinks, there's a higher mortality and a higher bone problems. So basically the dairy people with their ads, Got Milk, have been basically indoctrinating us and lying to us for a long time now, that we're so indoctrinated that we think milk is the way to go for calcium. Actually, calcium can come better and more easily absorbed. It doesn't have the alkaline phosphatase that tends to inhibit the absorption. Spinach and greens and beans and legumes, okay? You get all the calcium you need, basically. All right, we'll now go to, we're going to go back to some music, and then we go to Dr. Michael Murray.
Again, Jackie Ivanko.
Jackie Ivanko.
Every night in my dreams, I see you, I feel you, and that is how I know you. Oh, far across the distance and spaces between.
Oh, That was Jackie Evancho, a great singer, one of my favorite singers, singing My Heart Will Go On. And that's the song from the movie The Titanic, if you remember. Anyway, she's a wonderful singer. It's great to hear her again. Next, we're going to have Dr. Michael Murray. I used to hang out with Dr. Murray in the old days when I was teaching oncology at Bastyr University in Washington. We were kind of in a circle of friends that included Paul, whatever his name, the Sea Shepherd, and a number of people. So, but it's a long time ago since I've actually spoken to him. But he is very well informed. And he's got things pretty much together in a nice way. So it will be good for you to listen to what he has to say. I might interrupt here on and off in the show just to make things a little clearer maybe. But here we go. Dr. Michael Murray.
Doctor of Natural Medicine. I'm a graduate and I've served on the faculty and board of trustees of Bastyr University in Seattle. As I was going through my education process, it occurred to me that if natural medicine is based upon truth, that it should be able to stand up to scientific investigations. One of the great myths out there is that natural medicines aren't scientific. The truth of the matter is, for most common health conditions, we can build a stronger scientific case on the use of diet, lifestyle modification, attitude adjustment, and the proper use of dietary supplements than we can for many of the drugs that are in vogue. Over the last 30 years, I've written over 30 books, and these books are based on over 60,000 scientific articles that I've pulled from the medical literature. So I know firsthand what the scientific evidence states as it relates to these natural products. And I can assure you that, again, for most common health conditions, you should be looking to nature first and not to the drugs. As Bob mentioned, my latest book is an updated version of the Encyclopedia of Natural Medicine. This is a 1,200-page reference book that tells you what you can do to address over 100 different common health conditions. I have a whole chapter on silent inflammation, so I'm just going to give you kind of a crystallized view of that chapter tonight. We will have plenty of opportunity for questions and answers. And as Bob said, if you have additional questions, I'll be here tomorrow from 10 to 12. So I'm going to give you an overview on what is inflammation. We'll talk about what is silent inflammation. Then we'll look at some strategies to reduce that silent inflammation. If you fall down and scrape your knee, you have obvious inflammation. Obvious inflammation is characterized by redness, heat, swelling, pain, and dysfunction. Pretty obvious if you sprain your ankle or bruise your elbow, you have inflammation. But there's another type of inflammation that's not so obvious, and we refer to it as silent inflammation. This is a underlying factor in many different health conditions, and it's characterized by an interaction between our antioxidant system, which I'll talk about briefly, as well as our vascular lining and the production of various inflammatory compounds. This chronic silent inflammation is a center feature in virtually every chronic degenerative disease. This includes Alzheimer's disease, cancer, heart disease, as well as arthritis, intestinal inflammation, and a long list of other health conditions. How do we know if someone has silent inflammation? Well, there are some blood tests that can be done. How many people have heard of the C-reactive protein? This is a marker that tells us how much inflammation is going on in your body. And this marker is a very good...
This is probably the single most important blood test you can have when you go and visit your doctor. It's relatively new on the medical scene, but most doctors have really heard of it. But I don't think a lot of doctors are really cognizant of the value of that test in terms of to determine what level of chronic smoldering inflammation is going on in your body. Later on in this show, we'll name a few of the diseases that's caused by inflammation, and that they go on and on. Almost all chronic diseases due to chronic inflammation in your body. And a lot of that's due to the food we eat, the fries and all the other different kinds of food that we'll talk about in a minute. So you've got to know your number. Now, the average number taken by most laboratories is for normal is about 2. That's the average. You don't want to be average today. You want to be optimal. And so the optimal number is actually 1 and below. So as near to 0 as you can get. So don't take 2. Don't take the conventional number that the labs give out. That's just for the that's just taken from the average level of inflammation in the society. That's not good enough. You need to be at the optimal health. So the test is C-reactive protein. There's a few other tests for inflammation too, ESR, fibrinogen. We'll talk about later. Okay, we'll continue now with the talk.
Indicator of your risk for having a heart attack or stroke. There's also fibrinogen, which is another marker for a heart attack. This slide, what it's telling us is that a high C-reactive protein is a stronger predictor of having a heart attack than a high cholesterol level. About 50% of people that die of a heart attack have normal to low cholesterol levels. So cholesterol, the only reason we make such a big deal about it is because the drug companies want you to be taking their drugs to lower cholesterol. Heart disease is much more complex than that. And what's more important than your cholesterol level is the amount of inflammation that you have going on in your body as measured by the C-reactive protein. So what this slide is showing us, if we have a low C-reactive protein and a high LDL cholesterol, we have a lower risk of having a heart attack compared to a high C-reactive protein and a low LDL cholesterol. So a high CRP is more of a predictor of having a heart attack than a high level of LDL cholesterol. One of the key determinants of the level of C-reactive protein is our degree of insulin resistance. Now, I've talked about this in some of the other lectures. Insulin resistance is a very common condition in North America. When you're overweight, particularly if your waist is larger than your hips, you're likely insulin resistant. If you have type 2 diabetes, you're clearly insulin resistant. When we start gaining weight around our abdomen, collectively these fat cells start acting like a tumor. And what does a tumor want to do? It wants to grow. So these fat cells grow by secreting compounds that block the action of insulin. Insulin is a hormone that is supposed to bind to receptors on our cells to open up channels that allows glucose and other nutrients to enter that cell. So when we develop insulin resistance, we really set the stage for gaining more weight and eventually getting type 2 diabetes. Well, this insulin resistance is a centerpiece for developing heart disease and developing Alzheimer's disease, developing cancer, because it leads to significant inflammation. One of the things that happens with this insulin resistance is that it leads to your blood getting a bit too thick. And we measure blood thickness by looking at a substance called fibrinogen. This is a clotting factor, and it promotes heart disease, and it promotes the formation of these clots. So we don't want that. So this is another marker that you should have done when you go in for your yearly physical, C-reactive protein and fibrinogen. Fibrinogen levels carry with it high risk for having a heart attack. People who exercise regularly, eat vegetarian diets, and consume a little bit of alcohol have lower levels. Natural products to reduce fibrinogen include enzymes, particularly an enzyme from soy called natokinase, niacin, garlic, ginger, as well as other proteolytic enzymes. A lot of the negative effects of insulin resistance are due to the effects it has on our endothelial cells. Now, our endothelial cells are the cells that line our blood vessels. Now, if I stretched out all my endothelial cells flat, they would take up the space of about a football field. So this is a tremendous surface area in our body. And this is the area that's coming in contact with our blood. So with what we have circulating in our blood is coming in contact with the lining of the blood vessels. And these cells that line the blood vessels are very important in regulating inflammation. Some of the factors that cause damage to those cells lead to severe inflammation. So what are some of the things that can damage those endothelial cells? Well, we're going to look at those. We can also look at things that protect those endothelial cells, and they will reduce inflammation. So what are some things that we want to do to improve the function of these endothelial cells? Remember, these cells are very important in mediating inflammation. Well, diet, exercise, and proper supplementation. We want to enjoy these phytochemicals. What are phytochemicals? Well, these are compounds in our foods, plant foods, that protect our cells from being damaged. Some very good foods for protecting these endothelial cells are very healthful, like chocolate. Chocolate's very good. Green tea, red wine, richly colored fruits and vegetables in general are very helpful for those endothelial cells. The type of oils that we consume in the diet are also very important. Omega-3 fatty acids and monounsaturated fats that we get from olive oil and nuts and seeds. I want to talk about some superfoods to reduce inflammation. We have to start with diet to reduce inflammation. So these are examples of some superfoods, and I'll briefly describe a few of them. Everyone knows about blueberries, right? Of all these foods up here, and I asked this question, I think, last year, so some of you may know the answer, which one is regarded as having the highest level of antioxidants? Antioxidants are food compounds that protect against damage. How many people think it's broccoli? How many people think it's blueberries? How many people think it's tomatoes? How many people think it might be these small red kidney beans? It's these small red kidney beans. Okay? According to the United States Department of Agriculture, the food that has the highest antioxidant capacity of these foods shown are these small red kidney beans. So beans can be a good source of these beneficial compounds as well. So all of these foods on that slide, the beans, low gluten, whole grains, flavonoid-rich berries, citrus fruits, cruciferous vegetables, high carotene vegetables, salmon, lycopene sources like tomato, soy, nuts and seeds, green leafy vegetables, herbs and spices. These are anti-inflammatory foods, and this is where our diet should really be focused. You want to avoid foods that have the wrong type of fats. Particularly harmful are the animal fats. Arachidonic acid is an animal fat found in meat and dairy, and it's associated with producing more inflammation in our body. These sorts of foods are not good for fighting inflammation. These are very inflammatory foods. I know I'm preaching to the choir. I know none of you eat any of these foods. But you really have to avoid fried foods and foods that are high in that arachidonic acid. And these foods really are robbing us of our health. I mentioned earlier this role of insulin resistance, and it's an epidemic. And again, what happens is we start gaining weight around the abdomen. This central obesity leads to alterations in a number of compounds that produce insulin resistance and promote inflammation. And so we have this big positive feedback cycle really steamrolling and snowballing until we develop type 2 diabetes. These are some of the hormonal factors that are secreted by fat cells. Collectively, our fat cells now are thought of as being a component of our hormonal system. And what's going on when we start gaining that weight is that we see severe alterations in various hormones. And the bottom line is that these hormones block the action of insulin and promote inflammation. So we really, if we're talking about reducing inflammation, reducing silent inflammation, we have to look at improving the action of insulin. When you go in and you have a blood test for C-reactive protein and it's elevated, they've shown without question the biggest contributor to elevations in C-reactive protein is insulin resistance. They've also shown that diet can be very effective in lowering that inflammation. So we're going to talk about some dietary strategies, but before we get to that, I want to talk about a way to improve your insulin action through supplementation. Now, if you've come to my lectures before, I've mentioned the importance of PGX. What PGX is, it's a dietary supplement. It's available in capsules, it's available in granules, and it's the most important natural product in North America today. If you're overweight, if you have type 2 diabetes, if you have an elevation in C-reactive protein, you need to be very familiar with PGX. What it is, it's a super fiber. It's the first of what I think will be many super fibers. We take three natural fibers and we put them in this large chamber and mix it with water and agitate it under the right pressure and temperature to form a new molecule. This new molecule is called PGX, and it's able to bind more water than any other known fiber. So it binds more than 600 times its weight in water. So when you ingest it, it forms this gelatinous mass in your stomach. It's mainly composed of water. That tells your brain that you're satisfied, that you've got enough going on there. A 5-gram serving of PGX is equal to about 100 grams of psyllium, or about a bottle of Metamucil. Now, if you took a bottle of Metamucil, you're not going to feel like eating, trust me. The difference with the Metamucil is you're going to be very uncomfortable and you're probably going to have to call a plumber. With PGX, it's not uncomfortable. That mass is largely composed of water, and when PGX hits the small and large intestine, it basically evaporates into short-chain fatty acids because it's the most powerful prebiotic ever known. Prebiotics feed those health-promoting bacteria. So PGX is very important because it stimulates the action of insulin. We've been working with PGX now for almost 10 years. There are over 20 scientific investigations that show that PGX reduces the appetite and promotes weight loss. It increases the levels of compounds that promote satiety. Effective weight loss is not a matter of willpower or deprivation. It's about helping your brain feel satisfied. I mentioned that the way insulin works is that it binds to a receptor site on our cells and it opens up channels that allows glucose to enter into that cell. We have specialized brain cells that control our appetite. They're sensitive to insulin, or they should be. When we develop insulin resistance, blood sugar levels are high, but inside that cell, because the insulin's not opening up those channels, there's a relative insufficiency of nutrients, of glucose, in that cell. So what does that cell think? It thinks it's starving. So what's it going to do? It's going to move us to eat and eat foods that are going to quickly raise our blood sugar level. PGX has an unparalleled ability to stabilize blood sugar levels and improve our ability to control our appetite and help us reduce our calorie intake. The secret to weight loss, it's not about these, you know, metabolic enhancers or even exercising more for most people. The real key is helping people reduce the amount of calories that they consume. PGX is a tool that can help people do that nearly effortlessly. So PGX lowers the levels of compounds that tell your brain to eat while raising the levels of compounds that tell your brain that you're satisfied. So if you want more information on PGX, it's in your packet. But I think it's a very important strategy to lowering that systemic inflammation, particularly if you're carrying any excess weight around that midsection. Here are some other dietary recommendations. So we want to eat to improve insulin sensitivity. How do we do that? What else do we need to do? Well, we need to stay away from foods that are going to quickly raise our blood sugar level. They're inflammatory. Too much sugar in the diet is inflammatory. So stay away from refined sugar, refined carbohydrates. Stay away from soft drinks, candy. Stay away from too much fruit in the diet. Anything that's going to cause your blood sugar levels to rise rapidly. Identify and eliminate food allergies. Food allergies are a problem for a lot of people. And if when you have a food allergy, it really sets the stage towards absorbing compounds from your intestinal tract that shouldn't be absorbed. And it really leads to even greater inflammation than you would have if you didn't have food allergies. So the common food allergens are wheat, particularly gluten, milk, corn, soy, peanuts, eggs, and citrus. So sometimes staying away from those foods is a good way to judge whether or not you are allergic to them. This is especially easy if you have an allergic condition like eczema or asthma, or you have arthritis that seems to be associated with some inflammation. You can do a trial. Next, I recommend a rainbow assortment of fruits and vegetables. These pigments are very important in reducing inflammation. So one good goal every day is to get 5 servings of vegetables and 2 servings of fruit each day. A serving is defined as 1/2 cup cooked or 1 cup uncooked. So 5 servings of vegetables. French fries, potato chips, they don't count. Okay, green leafy vegetables are really good. Raw or cooked, I like to split it about 50-50. I tend to eat more raw food in the summer, more cooked food in the winter. These plant pigments are critical in protecting our cells from damage. They're very important in protecting those endothelial cells from damage. So 5 servings of vegetables, 2 servings of fruit per day. How many people think they get that? Okay? They've done dietary surveys, and only about 11% of Americans reach that goal of 5 per day. Again, if we don't count French fries and potato chips.
Actually, that number has gone up since this talk was given in 2013. So that number has gone up since then. It's now altogether 9. And so you could say 7 servings of vegetables and 2 servings of fruit, if you want to put it that way. Okay, we'll continue again.
Vegetables. So we got to get that intake up. The research is really clear. If you look at any chronic disease, heart disease, cancer, Alzheimer's disease, macular degeneration, cataracts, arthritis, any disease that's associated with aging, when they've looked at people that are able to eat 5 servings of fruits and vegetables each day, these people have a much lower rate of developing those health conditions. So this is a target. That's why the government has spent some money trying to get people to eat 5 a day. I'm telling you to eat a little bit more than that. I'm telling you eat 5 servings of vegetables, 2 servings of fruit. Now, if that seems like a lot to you, good. Focus on those big salads. It's easy to get, 5 cups of vegetables in a salad, right? That's a big salad, but don't douse it with a lot of, blue cheese dressing and high calorie dressing. Use flaxseed oil and make your own oil and vinaigrette. But try to keep the dressing low. But if we fill ourselves up on these high nutrient dense foods, low calorie but high nutrient, we're going to help our brain feel more satisfied. I think one of the reasons why we have a problem with obesity in America is that so many people are overfed but undernourished. And I think our brain cells really start responding to being fed when we feed them better nutrition. So 5 servings.
Okay, we're going to have to end on that note, but we will continue Dr. Murray's talk next Tuesday from, again, 7 to 8. He ended in that note that we're a nation that's overfed and undernourished, which is quite correct. Most of the food, fast foods we eat, are calorie-rich but nutrients-poor. So we need to change our diet to food low in calories but high in micronutrients like vitamins and minerals, etc., etc. Okay, it was good being with you for the last hour, and I hope you've learned something that will add to your repertoire in the future when you have to make strong decisions about your health, that everyone starts moving into that as we get older. And we don't have to be totally reliant on statin drugs and the lies that the drug companies and the pushers of drugs. We're actually 4% of the world's population, but we consume over 40% of the total manufactured drugs in the world. So we're actually drug to the hilt, and it's probably going to get worse. And you have no idea of the power of the drug companies. The money they make is used to push drugs onto kids, to push psychiatric drugs every year. So we're actually a nation that really drugged. I feel so sorry for people. They just don't know what's going on around them. Even the medical literature is actually largely controlled by the drug companies. I can quote people who was New England Journal of Medicine for 25 years is stating this, that it's a total sham, that the medical journals, that and that one also is heavily influenced by the drug companies. So I'm so sorry to have to tell you that news, that the poor people who just don't know what's going on around them. All right, so you're listening, you have been listening to 103.1 FM, and this is the Dr. Mike's Health and Wellness show, I suppose you could call it. We look forward to meeting you, to being with you again next Tuesday from 7 to 8. You can access some of these shows. The archive is at radioforall.net. The 4 is the number 4, radioforall.net. And you put into the search engine the name of the program you want to see. If you put in Dr. Mike's Health, M-I-K-E-S, Health and Wellness, you'll come up with some of these shows. And if you put in, before I used to combine my two shows together, and the title was Health and the Awakening of the Self, you'll come up with a lot more shows. So you can either put that title in, Dr. Mike's Health and Wellness, or you can put Health and the Awakening of the Self into the search engine, and then the shows will come up, a list of shows. So you press whichever number, their numbers, whatever number you want to watch. You have to press it twice. Actually, the first time you press it, a window opens up, tells you a little about it. And then you press it again, and after you press it again, you go down to the bottom of the page and you press the red arrow. You can do this on your smartphone, or you can do this on your computer. Okay, so you have the archives there. And so I suggest also, if you have a health condition and you want to inform yourself more about it, go to YouTube and you'll find lots of really good teachers there. Lots of experts in areas of health, and particularly the one area of health that you're restricted on. Okay, bye for the moment. I'm going to play us out with some music. It'll be, let's see who it is going to be. Again, it's Think of Me. It's Jackie Evancho again. Think of Me.